I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. The Spanish flu of 1918 led to more than a half million deaths in this country. What if a pandemic like that were to hit now? Intensive care units already are frequently strained to capacity. If there were a severe pandemic, there wouldn't be enough resources to go around, like life-saving ventilators. Whose lives should be saved first? Should it be first come, first served? Should children get priority? Should we remove a ventilator from an ailing patient if another, healthier patient has a better chance of surviving? Should we treat healthcare workers first? A team of Maryland doctors has asked the public to weigh in on these thorny ethical decisions. We'll speak with two of them on Midday after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm very glad you've joined us. We're talking today about what could happen if there were a serious medical crisis in Maryland, a pandemic or other disaster that created more patients than our medical system could handle. Which of those patients should get a share of limited resources? This may seem like the sort of life or death decision that couldn't happen in a developed country like the United States, but it has happened in recent memory. 11 years ago, for example, during Hurricane Katrina, doctors had to decide which patients to evacuate first from hospitals as the floodwaters rose. A team of Maryland doctors is trying to spare their colleagues such agonizing decisions. They are crafting guidelines for state officials, developing a framework for medical professionals to follow in a crisis. And they're figuring these guidelines out by talking to the public. The researchers asked hundreds of citizens all over the state to participate in spirited debates about who should get priority in an emergency. Here's a clip from one of those meetings in Howard County. This is from a recent Radiolab episode titled Playing God, reported by journalist Sherry Fink.
Those protocols will be black and white.
I've never seen any situation in life where it was black or white.
Some things are black and white.
Well, my immediate reaction to the lottery was it's a leveler. It's all the same.
I think it is the scientifically least responsible way to go.
I think ultimately it's fair.
If somebody's going to live but be very sick, should that go into the decision?
If we've set up guidelines, then yes.
Is every kind of doctor, you know what I mean, going to be essential?
No, I didn't say that. No.
Those were some of the voices of Maryland citizens who have been asked to grapple with the ethical questions that could arise in healthcare during a disaster. I have two of the project's leaders with me here in the studio. Lee Dougherty Bittison is a critical care physician and vice chair in the Department of Medicine at Johns Hopkins. Welcome to Midday.
Thank you for having me.
I'm glad you could come. And Eric Toner is an emergency physician and senior associate at the UPMC Center for Health Security, part of the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, but the center is based here in Baltimore. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you for having us.
Lee Dougherty Bittison, was there a particular crisis that spurred you to want to create these guidelines? What did this project grow out of?
This project grew out of some efforts that we had embarked on at Johns Hopkins, where we really were actually in the wake of Katrina thinking about how we would handle a similar situation if it were to happen here in Baltimore. And we asked the questions about what staff would take care of patients, what equipment we would use, where we would put patients, if we had many more patients than we were normally used to taking care of. And we spent months wrestling with those questions. But the ultimate question that lay behind those is, what if all of our planning isn't enough and there's still more patients? How are we going to make decisions about who gets the resources?
So who was the discussions you're describing that led to what if it's not enough, we still need to manage a scarcity? Who was in the conversation at that point? Describe the kind of group it was.
Sure. Well, we had a multidisciplinary group that was engaged in that surge planning process. So nurses, doctors, social workers, ethicists, members of the chaplain service, all across our institution. At that point in the conversation, we were really focused on what was happening at at our hospital. And at that point, we realized, hey, this is much, much bigger than us. That should have maybe been obvious at the very beginning, but became very, very clear the more we had the conversation. This is much bigger than us. It's not just what happens at Hart Hospital. It's what happens across the entire state. And it's important for us to involve other voices before we come up with any kind of plan to respond to the situation.
So that group, the group in the hospital said, we need to reach outside the hospital.
That's right.
And how did, Dr. Toner, how did you get pulled into this?
Well, Lee and I had both been working on national task forces, working on issues related to this. And this really came up, I think, starting with 9/11 and then Katrina and then all the concerns around bird flu in 2007. And people started to think about this. And so Lee approached me and said, I have this crazy idea. Why don't we talk to people about this and talk to everyday people, the public, and see how they feel about it, how they think about this. So she approached me.
And how did you get, either of you get an idea about, okay, how to put together a sample of the public to engage in this conversation?
So we actually have some wonderful collaborators in Pittsburgh. Some of them are at another part of the University of Pittsburgh that Eric is associated with. And then also folks at Carnegie Mellon, they have a program called the Program for Deliberative Democracy. And theirs is the methodology that we used. This methodology draws groups of people from the public together, engages them in informed conversation. So not just a quick poll or a telephone call, robocall, what do you think about this, that, or the other, but here's some information about a complex situation. Let's discuss it as a group and talk about what our values are, what's most important, and come to some mutual understanding as a community. In terms of the sample that you asked about how we decided to engage different individuals, some of the original work that was done by the Program for Deliberative Democracy was done using random digit dialing and sort of this true random sample. That's actually very cumbersome and quite financially expensive. So we used a little bit different methodology where we reached out to different stakeholders and interest groups, so faith communities or disaster preparedness communities, to hospitals across the state, and asked them to help us recruit individuals to participate in the conversation.
We also put up flyers in grocery stores, and we used Craigslist and or even some public radio ads.
So you used multiple ways
Yes.
to assemble these folks, and you were asking them to make what seems to me like a pretty big commitment. These meetings were where these discussions happened were not short. They were like 4 or 5 hours?
Right. Yeah. It was a full day. It was a full Saturday for most of them.
Full Saturday for most of them. We've just established it was a big chunk of time that people were engaged. I know we can't replicate it in the time span of midday, but I would like the people who are tuned in who are interested enough to be listening to us to get some sense of what was the ethical dilemma that was presented. How did you present it, and how did you get the conversation started? Either one of you.
All right. Well, I think it's my turn.
Excuse me.
So we gave them a scenario of a severe flu pandemic, essentially tried to recreate for them the great pandemic of 1918. So the conditions we set for them was there are thousands, maybe tens of thousands of people who are critically ill in their state. The hospitals are overwhelmed. It involves the entire nation. There's no possibility of external resources, and it'll last for months. So we gave them some facts about the 1918 pandemic. The WHO, the World Health Organization, described it as the most deadly disease event in the history of humanity. It's estimated that up to 100 million people died around the world, and most of those people died in a 24-week period. More people died of the flu that year than died in the first 24 years of the AIDS pandemic. More people died of flu during that short period of time than died in the 100 years of the Black Death. More people died of flu during that period than died in all the wars of the 20th century. In the U.S., it's estimated that 675,000 people died. Most of them died within a few months. In any individual locale, most of the deaths occurred in a period of about 6 weeks. So it was very intense. We gave them the further example of what happened in Philadelphia in October of 1918. With a population of just under 2 million people, it was estimated there were 500,000 people sick at one time, that the number of people who died per day of flu in the beginning of October was one per day. And within about 10 days, it went up to 760 people per day were dying of the flu. In the hospitals, approximately 25% of the inpatient population died each day from flu. And in the week of October 16th of that year, almost 5,000 people died in that week.
Okay. In deference to time,
yeah,
I will stipulate, as I think most of the listeners were, that you're describing a very intense, very scary pandemic where death was all around. And you're saying, I think you were saying to the folks you're assembling in the last few years to have these conversations, what if something like that happened now?
Right.
What is the scarcity that we would face now? Or things have changed since 1918 in terms of what's available.
Yeah, so ventilators weren't available in 1918, and that's the resource we decided to focus on. So using CDC's planning assumptions and some software modeling that CDC has made available, we modeled what might happen if a similar pandemic happened in Maryland and determined that we might need 7 times as many ventilators in a severe pandemic as now exist, just to take care of flu patients, not counting all the people who normally get ventilators for all other reasons. So it would be a time of intense shortage.
So we'd be short, here in Maryland, we'd be short, tens of thousands?
Yes.
Of ventilators. There'd be tens of thousands of patients who might benefit. And so how did you tell them you've got this group of people, who you've convinced them there's a really scary situation we're trying to figure out how we would handle. Did you give them some suggestions for ways to approach this?
Yes, we did. So we framed the conversation throughout the time period that we were together once we'd given them this scenario in terms of 6 ethical principles. We made it clear that there are a number of, while not any ethical approaches, okay, there are a number of ethical approaches that have reasonable arguments supporting them. And those 6 included saving the most lives, saving the most life years, the life cycle principle.
I have to interrupt and ask you, what's the life cycle principle?
I will be happy to share that. So the life cycle principle essentially seeks to give persons an equal chance to live through the stages of life.
Oh.
So in this case, younger patients would receive priority over older patients because they've lived through, teenagers would receive priority over middle-aged individuals because they've lived through fewer stages of life.
Okay. So number of lives, number of life years.
Right.
How many years of health you presumably have left. So life cycle. Mm-hmm. And what else?
So just a little bit of explanation on the life years piece to sort of differentiate. What we really tried to focus on there was underlying illnesses. So if you were to get better from the flu, what underlying illnesses might shorten your life? If you had end-stage cancer, for example, you probably would live fewer years than someone who didn't. So there was that differentiation there. The fourth principle that we offered people as a possible construct to use was one called instrumental value. And instrumental value essentially prioritizes those individuals who have an immediate impact on the response to the disaster. So we use instrumental value to decide who receives a vaccine, for example. So with 2009 H1N1, vaccine workers and healthcare providers were prioritized to receive that so they could remain well and care for other individuals. And then we said, maybe what we need to do is just stick with what happens on an everyday basis, which is first come, first served. First people in the door who demonstrate a need for this resource, for this ventilator, could be given it, and they give it in the order that they arrive. And lastly, we said, perhaps we want to not use any of those and rather focus on a lottery and just give everyone who needs a ventilator a number and we'll pull out of a hat. And that way, you know, there's sort of an equivalent chance for everyone to get one at any given point in time.
So we need to take a quick break here. We have laid out essentially the ethical dilemma that you laid out to your discussion groups. And I'm asking listeners, if you, in hearing this, have an idea about how you would answer the question of how, in a pandemic, should a scarce resource, in this case we're talking about a ventilator, which could have a big impact on whether or not someone survives the flu, who should have access and how should that decision be made? You can call us at 410-662-8780, or you can send us an email if you'd like to respond that way. Our email address is midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about how to craft guidelines for doctors to follow in the event of a pandemic that requires more from hospitals than they can give. Which patients should get priority? How do you make that decision? My guests are physicians Lee Dougherty-Bittison and Eric Toner. They're leading a project which asks the public to weigh in on the ethical questions that could arise during a health crisis. You are welcome to be part of this conversation. We've laid out some of the ways to approach it, but you may have your own thoughts about how to approach something like apportioning ventilators in the event of a flu pandemic. You can call us at 410-662-8780, or you can send an email to midday@wypr.org. Dr. Bittison, are there other projects like yours? Are other people around the country, other groups trying to figure out how to do this kind of thing?
So there are a number of protocols that are in the public sphere. New York State was one of the first to engage in that. There's been some work done in Texas, in the Houston area. There's also been work done in Seattle with Public Health Seattle. King County has done a lot of work engaging the public. And there are more other endeavors happening as a result of some of the work of the Institute of Medicine on this very important issue. Additionally, separate from the community engagement pieces, there are state legislatures that have engaged in asking the question. States like Massachusetts and Virginia also have protocols in place.
So what's different about what you're doing in Maryland, or is it different?
So we think it is different, and we're excited about that. One of the key things that is new or different about this approach is that we have decided to sit down with members of the community before a framework is drafted. So in other communities, in other states, there have been a group of subject matter experts, for example, who have crafted a framework and then taken it to the public for comment. And we decided to reverse the order there, and rather than sort of biasing the public or having the potential to bias the public towards an outcome or a solution, ask them first before the framework is drafted and get that input so that we can use it to form the framework in the first place.
Well, it sort of crossed my mind as you were laying out some of the ideas that you shared with your discussion groups, whether they might want to prioritize saving the maximum number of lives or the maximum years of life that patients would have, or do it by a lottery, or do it first come, first served, or maximize who gets to go through most of a life cycle. But in a way, you were laying out options, but you were also structuring the conversation. I mean, Dr. Toner, in that sense, is it very different than actually telling a group, this is what we think is the best approach? What do you think of that?
Well, in order to have a productive conversation, we had to set some parameters. So we had to choose ethical principles that had been widely vetted through by professional ethicists. And we did entertain any suggestion that anybody had. If somebody had an alternative way of thinking about it, we listened to that and considered it. Some things we would not consider. So allocation decisions based on race or gender or political affiliation, you know, things like that were off the table. We would not engage in conversation about those things. But, you know, if somebody had a different way of thinking about it, we were happy to hear that. We didn't hear a lot of that. Most people came around to thinking about, you know, these issues that we suggested to them. But with a lot of nuanced and creative ways of thinking about it.
And I want to ask you more about that, but we do have some listeners who want to offer their suggestions. Janie has called us from Baltimore. Janie, welcome to the show.
Thank you. The point I wanted to make was that in these emergency situations, that whatever qualifiers become identified to prioritize who gets treatment and who doesn't, it would be interesting to experiment with a point system so that the subjectivity that people and the emotional state that people are in when they're trying to make these differentiating life and death decisions are not under additional stress emotionally. I'm sure there would be exceptions. Point system might not always be used, but I think it would standardize things and expedite things to the collective benefit.
Janie, I want to make sure I understand. Are you saying that with a point system you could both, you could combine several of the values that Dr. Bittison laid out for us, like you could assign a value to years of life, but you could also assign a value to usefulness in the public's handling of the situation?
Exactly. And in addition to what's already been referred to, pre-existing health conditions. All these things would have some kind of prioritization and points assigned to them. It's just one way to expedite a situation and maximize the outcomes. There are going to be exceptions in situations like this. And there are going to be people that can't go by whatever the rule is, and they want to make their own decision in the moment. That's humans and their empathy. But for those that would be able to, it would be like making the decision-making process being in an ER all the time.
Well, let me see what the doctors who have been thinking about this so hard, whether they've encountered this. Janie, I appreciate the call. What goes through your mind when you hear Janie?
So there, Janie makes a couple of really important points. One of them is this idea about combining principles, because that was something that we heard often from other members of the public, that not just one principle didn't capture the priorities of folks we talked to, that there were either they would be used in combination at the same time or maybe used in series. And by that, I mean, so you might make an assessment about the number of life years someone had left. And if there were a group within that that were equivalent, then you would use a lottery or something like that. So they could be used either in combination or in series. The other the point that Janie makes that I think is so important and part of what we're trying to mitigate in doing this is that this scenario will generate a tremendous amount of stress for providers. So having this conversation now and building a framework now when things are calm, when we're not in a crisis situation, is incredibly important to minimize that stress, that anxiety. We can't mitigate it entirely. It will be stressful, but whatever we can do to help manage that by planning ahead, we think is really important and sort of the whole point of what we're trying to get at here.
Dr. Toner, did you tend to get the same range of comments? We haven't really described it. Let me ask you that first. Where were these discussions held?
We held 15 of these day-long forums across the state over a course of 2 years, and we held them in every part of the state. We were on the Eastern Shore, we were in inner city Baltimore, we were in Howard County, we were out in Western Maryland, up in Bel Air, and down in the D.C. suburbs. So we held them all over the state. So we talked to really quite a diverse group of people.
And was there a consensus that bubbled up from in all of these places? How, actually, before I ask you if there was a consensus, I should ask you how different were the conversations? How much did they tend to gravitate to the same points, and how much did they just seem like a completely different conversation, say, in Frederick compared to Bel Air?
Well, I was struck by how similar the conversations were. So contrasting inner city Baltimore with Howard County, which were our first two forums, in many ways the conversations were the same. They were nuanced. People were really thoughtful. Janie was a good example of what we've heard, people thinking deeply and with good insight about these issues and very willing to consider it and talk about it and do so in a small group in a very civil way. It was really a wonderful thing to see. We didn't ask for consensus. No, we didn't ask for a vote on principles. We wanted to hear how people think about it. And it is true that in most of the locations, most people came down to favoring a principle that saved the most number of lives or life years, some combination of that. But it's also very important how the minority of people thought about it. And the issues of social justice, the issues of fairness, the issues of access to care, the issues of political disenfranchisement that we heard to some extent on the Western Maryland and on the Eastern Shore. Those are all really important, cofactors in thinking about this issue.
Listeners, you can tell us what you think about how to approach this with a phone call to 410-662-8780 or an email to midday@wypr.org. This is Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. Usha has phoned us from Bel Air. Usha, welcome to Midday.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, we hear you fine.
Okay. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about this. I'm a physician, but I'm not in critical care. The one thing that strikes me about the youth argument and the life cycle argument is that we don't exist without one another. We coexist. So if you take a teenager, let's say between the ages of 13 and 17, and let's say several family members come in, or the teenager is dependent on a grandmother for survival or on a mother for survival, and they come in and you're overwhelmed. I mean, when you decide to save that teenager and you decide to not to save another adult connected to the teenager, you might actually be orphaning that teenager and letting that teenager go adrift. I mean, maybe the person will be adopted later on, but it would be such a difficult decision for me to make. And the other thing that I'm thinking about is our jailed population, how we treat them. I've listened to, read many articles about how epidemics start over there, why it is so important to vaccinate them and treat them well medically, and also our homeless population. They can create a public health crisis, and it is so important to treat them well in the first place to prevent diseases, and also if they fall prey to treat them well. And those are important considerations, I think, when you're thinking about whom to save and whom not to save.
Usha, I appreciate your putting those thoughts on the table. Any reactions to her points?
So I think Usha makes a really important point about age, and this is one that we heard in many of our forums. There was an impulse to save children. Many people said, if it were between me and my grandchild, me and my niece or nephew, me and my child, I would want my child, my grandchild, my niece or nephew to have that resource. But the very question that followed after that is, well, who will take care of that person? And there was a lot of tension around that that went unresolved. And I think it will be an important question for us to consider moving forward.
By the way, let me just do a quick medical reality check. I completely understand the value in the discussion with having an intervention like the ventilator seen as the life or the difference between life and death. But as a practical matter in treating flu, is a ventilator really that binary an intervention?
Yes.
It really is. Okay. So if people get the impression that without a ventilator, if I've got a bad case of flu, I'm in trouble, that's a fair conclusion to take away from this.
Clearly, there are many more people who have very mild cases of the flu who don't need that. But with severe flu and associated pneumonia and respiratory failure, you definitely would require a ventilator.
That is Dr. Lee Dougherty-Bittison here on Midday on WIPR. Also with us is Dr. Eric Toner. We're talking about a project to figure out how to organize scarce resources in the event of a pandemic. David has called us from Baltimore. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Just a quick question. I'm kind of wondering how this, what they're talking about, is really very different from what they kind of already do in a crisis, which is to triage patients. It seems like this might be adding a lot of extra steps to something that has to happen, you know, under stress and crisis.
David, thanks for the question. Dr. Toner?
Well, there's not one kind of triage. There are many kinds of triage. There's the kind of triage that's done by first responders, EMS personnel. There's kind of triage that's done in the emergency department, and there's battlefield triage. And they all work on different principles. They all work on, you know, different assumptions. In the emergency department, for example, we triage the sickest person first. If you come in with a heart attack, you go first. If you have a sprained ankle, you go last. This is different. And it might be that we want to take the sickest person first, but that may not be the best choice in this situation. We may want to take the person who's most likely to survive, who may not be the sickest person. So what we're trying to do is come up with what would be the triage protocol, the triage framework for this situation where there are not enough ventilators for everybody, because normal triage assumes that there are enough resources for everybody.
So triage is a fair word to describe this.
Yes.
And you've asked for public involvement in a particular kind of triage, which raises for me the question, when you're able to digest all this, and I'm very impressed with your capability of living with indecision and unclear outcomes, because I don't think I could do at all what you're doing in terms of trying to come up with some guidelines out of this. Would these guidelines apply in any other situation than an influenza pandemic where ventilators are in short supply? Is that the only question that this is answering? You're looking at each other like, I don't know what to make of the look you just exchanged.
This is the million-dollar question and an important one for our team to consider. So the answer is we're not sure yet, to be honest with you. There are reasons why it would make sense to extrapolate some of the findings that we've gathered from the ventilator example to other critical care resources that might occur in other types of disasters. And there are also mitigating circumstances which would make a large group of casualties, for example, from a bomb blast or an earthquake, a different situation than a pandemic. It's a question we'll be weighing as we put together the framework.
But it's clearly emergency. I mean, for example, ongoing shortages in organs for transplant or in certain kinds of drugs. Will the scarcity guidelines that you come up with be applicable in those situations, these sort of everyday shortages that the medical system deals with?
In one word, no. We are addressing situations in a catastrophic emergency. We are not addressing day-to-day shortages. However, we think that this same approach, the same methodology, the deliberative democracy approach, could be used to address things like critical shortages of pediatric chemotherapy drugs, which is a national crisis right now. We are not doing that in this project, but we think that would be really interesting to do.
And that this technique that
this
you're using could do it.
Yes.
We need to take another quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk more about the question of who should come first when medical resources are limited. You can join this conversation. You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. You can phone us at 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. If you're just joining us, we're talking today about the possibility of a pandemic or other widespread disaster overwhelming the medical system. If there were a flu pandemic, How would you allocate the ventilators that could save patients' lives? My guests, Johns Hopkins critical care physician Lee Dougherty-Bittison and emergency physician Eric Toner, are crafting guidelines for the state with input from the public. You can be part of this conversation on Midday. You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org or phone us at 410-662-8780. We got an email from Jerry, who says, Sheila, if all of the ventilators are used up, how would the life cycle or age category work? Which I think tees up the question of how did the public in your conversations deal with that question?
Well, that's a very insightful question that was asked, and one of the questions that we challenged our participants with, and it's the question of reallocation. In a severe pandemic, we think that all the ventilators would be taken up, pretty quickly. Whatever principle you use, we think that most of the ventilators will be used within the first few weeks. And so what of people who come later? If you can't allow the possibility of reallocation, then nobody will have access later on. And so we asked people how they thought about this. Ethicists have weighed in on this, and they think that allocation and reallocation are ethically equivalent.
So it's sort of like every day you either get the ventilator that day or you don't. The fact that you had it the day before is a separate – is not really
– No. So what we asked people would it ever be permissible to remove somebody from a ventilator who needs it in order to give it to somebody else who needs it? Mm-hmm. Knowing that if you remove somebody from a ventilator who needs it, they're going to die. Mm-hmm. And the person who needs it, doesn't get it, is going to die. So how do you make that choice? If you're going by their underlying health status, those who are most likely to survive, somebody who gets a ventilator because when they came in, they met the criteria. But somebody who comes in later who meets the criteria even better wouldn't have access if you don't reallocate. So what we ask people is reallocation acceptable to you?
And was there a general response to that?
The general response was everybody, both the lay public and professionals, health professionals, were very uncomfortable with this idea of reallocation.
More uncomfortable with the idea of originally allocating.
Exactly. But over time, as we talked about it, over the course of an hour, most people came around to understanding that reallocation would be necessary, but always felt that it would be uncomfortable and always felt it would be really hard to do. But they understood that without the possibility of reallocation, there would be no ventilators for people who came later.
So as an example, as you turn to writing these guidelines, turning all this input into something that can guide your medical colleagues, how do you express that? How will that show up in a guideline that people are really, really uncomfortable with this particular aspect?
So one of the approaches that was discussed and suggested actually by the public, not by us, but we thought it was quite insightful, was to give people once an individual had received a ventilator, had been allocated a ventilator, that person should receive sort of a fair trial on it, so to speak. So it wouldn't be that you would give a patient a ventilator at 1 minute and then take it away an hour later, but rather once they were allocated this resource, they were, cared for for a period of time. 3-5 days, something like that, would depend upon the nature of the pandemic. And if they failed to get better or seemed to get worse, that would be a demonstration they weren't really benefiting from that resource. And maybe in that context, that resource could be reallocated, would be one approach to that.
We got an email from Alan. An email from Dave, who says, normally I would say first come, first served, but in such a situation where too many are in need, the professionals that will save more lives should have the first right of safety in this situation. That is one of the options that you laid out to people. Mm-hmm. But Julie raises another question. Julie's calling us from Baltimore. Hi, Julie.
Hi there. My question was, when you're taking into account who is going to receive this essential treatment first, how do you factor in, and do you factor in health insurance and ability to pay for these services?
Interesting question, Julie.
We explicitly did not consider that. And as one of our ground rules for these discussions, we told people that ability to pay or insurance status was not a consideration.
And is that practical in drafting these guidelines?
It's actually federal law.
So in a pandemic, in this kind of emergency,
it would not be a factor.
Julie, I'm glad you raised that question. We got an email from, I'm not sure who it's from. My father contracted Guillain-Barré syndrome 60 years ago after a bout with flu. My parents had health insurance, but it did not cover use of an iron lung. My father died a few hundred... I'm not quite sure how we got into this situation, but the writer concludes, my father died a few hundred feet from the iron lung. My family paid an enormous emotional price, financial too, for that decision. So I'm not quite sure of the decision. Oh, I'm sorry. My parents had health insurance. It did not cover the use of an iron lung. At any rate, it's a story that I'm not quite making out here about an insurance complication, but you're saying that it doesn't have to be part of what you're looking at.
Yeah. The federal law requires that anybody in medical need be stabilized. And so this would be the situation would apply. They would get the resources that would be available regardless of their ability to pay. That's not to say that there wouldn't be bills later, but one cannot be denied care because of their ability to pay or not.
Well, but this then also then your answers raise for me the question of did your discussions deal with limitations of medical personnel in a pandemic? Whether because many of these answers are how this patient's going to be monitored, how medical personnel will treat, will pay attention, and I'm picturing a situation where the attention of doctors and nurses and other professionals is overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. Is that something you dealt with?
So it is an issue that came up or was mentioned, but mostly in passing. We really focused on the ventilator piece. But the point you make is an important one. Someone has to operate the ventilator. Somebody has to make adjustments in what the amount of support a patient is given. Excuse me. Some have to make some assessments about when the patient's ready to come off. So it could be that in a disaster scenario, there would be enough ventilators and not enough people to operate them. And I think the similar principles would apply because, in effect, if you don't have the staff needed to operate that equipment, you don't have the equipment.
Mm-hmm. And so that will be part of the guidelines that you'll write?
Well, we'll definitely consider it now.
Natasha is calling from Randallstown with, I think, an important question. Natasha, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi.
What part does euthanasia play in this? Well, say, for instance, someone is deadly ill using equipment. How would you determine the euthanasia part of it? Thank you.
Natasha, thanks for raising that.
So euthanasia is outside of the bounds of this conversation. Euthanasia is not legal in this country and was really not part of the conversation. I think sometimes that the line is blurred because people want to know, well, what happens if I don't get that resource? And the conversation that was had and that will be an important part of our framework is that all other supportive measures that are available should be offered to that person, whether it be pain control, whether it be whatever can be done to support and make that person comfortable. But the idea of euthanasia implies hastening death. And that's not part of this framework or part of the conversation.
We talked about different situations that, you, Dr. Toner, told us this is a catastrophic emergency we're talking about, not daily management of shortages in the health system. But also, I'm curious as to both the geographic stretch of these conclusions, because you did find some differences in the way somebody in Howard County versus the Eastern Shore versus Western Maryland. So is a state the right geographic area to be looking at, or should it be bigger than that? Does this need to be a national consensus?
It would be wonderful if we could have a national framework. It's not really practical. It really has to do with state law, and so because so much of this is actually embodied in state law, it probably has to be organized state by state. We would hope that what we do in Maryland will be a model for other states, and we hope that what we do is consistent with other states that are working on this issue, and eventually there will be a national consensus on how to approach this. We don't know, and that's probably a long way off.
Okay, analogous question. How often does one need to take the public's temperature on this? I mean, you started these meetings about 4 years ago, I think, but you were planning them before that. Time of a lot of public discussion, at least in some quarters, about death panels and, and rationing in that sense. Since then, there's been a lot of public discussion about Black Lives Matter. Would that change the conversation? I don't know. And I'm not asking you to speculate unless you want to. But I am curious as to how stable are these non-consensus understandings that you have of where the public is?
I think that's a great question, and not to cheat on the answer, but I don't think anyone knows how quickly or how frequently we would need to reassess public opinion. I think an awareness on the part of our state leadership and anyone who was involved in this planning process that this reassessment may be necessary is an important one. I don't think that we should set aside the project as a once and done situation, but I think it is unclear at this point. And to my knowledge, methodology as it's been applied to other situations has not been replicated over time.
So what happens now? What's next?
So our project for this year is to try and draft a state framework that would be adopted by both the state of Maryland and the hospital systems and the stakeholder groups in Maryland, and that this would be a set of guidelines that physicians and hospitals could use if, God forbid, we're ever in this situation.
Dr. Bittison, you pointed out to us earlier that where Maryland is taking a different approach was involving the public first before there was a written draft to comment on. Once there's a draft, are you sending it back to the public for more comment, or do you think you've already got that built in?
So I think they're built into our project plan are a couple phases of getting feedback. So we'll engage we'll work with some subject matter experts to help us really understand the data that we've gathered. And then we will be engaging stakeholders in various healthcare communities across the state. And then hopefully, once we've had a couple of opportunities to refine what we've put together, we'll have some opportunity for public comment again. We may not do the same methodology. It's incredibly time-consuming, as you've mentioned, but we certainly will be open to public feedback.
This is really interesting. I take my hat off to both of you. Emergency physician Eric Toner, senior associate at the UPMC Center for Health Security. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And thanks to Lee Daugherty Bittison, a critical care physician at Johns Hopkins and vice chairwoman in the Department of Medicine. I'm so glad you could be with us.
Thank you.
Lunch for our midday guests provided by Dangerously Delicious Pies, with locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the Square in Canton and 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Their menu includes a variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. Website, dangerouspiesvault.com. And thank you for listening. I'm Sheila Cast. I hope you have a great afternoon, and we'll be back with us tomorrow.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.